This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The reality is that this is a tragedy that could long have been foreseen and that was really, in a sense, written in the stars already back in 2018, 2019, when the so-called December Revolution took place.
That's Harry Verhoeven, a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, who says the battle for control between the military leaders in Sudan has been brewing for a long time. Details coming up. Also, the death toll from a Saturday night attack by gunmen in Nigeria has risen to 33, and a South African court orders a four-month postponement in the trial of former President Jacob Zuma. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A third day of fighting between Sudan's military and the paramilitary rapid support forces raged today in the capital, with both sides claiming control of strategic sites. A doctors' union says around 100 people have been killed in the clashes as calls for a ceasefire are growing. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The sounds of gunfire echoed across the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, and other towns Monday afternoon. The military headquarters, Khartoum International Airport, and areas around the presidential palace are the current main battlefields between the military and the rapid support forces. The shooting affected the power supply and water system in the capital, making life more difficult for those trapped indoors by the fighting and people wounded in the clashes. In the Kalakla neighborhood south of Khartoum, the situation seems to be relatively calm, and people venture out to get basic necessities. Wissal Muhammad, a mother of three, says this is the first time in 3 days she's coming out to get food for her children. She says the situation is difficult and we are stranded. There is no electricity and power, and we cannot be mobile if there is an emergency. We are approaching the festivity time and people are just indoors. The fighting started on Saturday morning and Sudanese doctors say nearly 100 people have been killed and several others injured, including civilians, during the past 3 days. Hamid Babikir sells vegetables along the Jebel Awliya highway south of Khartoum. He told VOA that he is unable to order more stock from the central market due to the tense situation. He says roads are blocked and we cannot risk going out to get vegetables. What I am selling today is a leftover from yesterday. Everybody keeps on complaining of the tense situation and increase in prices because of a lack of fuel. Al-Mois Hassan is a grocer in the Abu Adam neighborhood south of Khartoum. He says he is worried about the robbery and has only partially opened his shop as a protection. He called on the warring parties to put the interests of the country and civilians as the first priority. He says the fighting has affected all the shops, not only mine. I'm not afraid of anything rather than losing lives. The two who are fighting are all Sudanese and are only following orders. We hope that God will change their hearts. The military said this afternoon that they had restored control over the state-run TV and radio, which was taken over by the RSF yesterday. The East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, has delegated the presidents of South Sudan, Kenya, and Djibouti to talk to the Sudanese warring parties in an effort to halt the fighting. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Just a short time ago, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the violence in Sudan and called for those with influence on the fighting to work to bring peace.
The humanitarian situation in Sudan was already precarious and is now catastrophic. I condemn the deaths and injuries to civilians and humanitarian workers and the targeting and looting of premises. I remind all parties of the need to respect international law, including ensuring the safety and security of all United Nations and associated personnel and humanitarian aid workers. I have spoken during the weekend with the two Sudanese leaders, and I am actively engaging with the AU, the Arab League, and leaders across the region. And I reaffirm that the United Nations stands with the people of Sudan at this very difficult time, with full support for their efforts to restore the democratic transition and build a peaceful, secure future.
Sudan's military and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary, RSF, have battled for control of key sites in Khartoum and other cities for 3 days. General Abdel Fattah Borhan leads the armed forces and General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo commands the RSF. Earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and U.K. Foreign Secretary James Cleverly called for a ceasefire.
We have been consulting very closely on the situation in Sudan. We've also been in close touch with partners in the Arab world, in Africa, in international organizations. There is a shared deep concern about the fighting, the violence that's going on in Sudan, the threat that poses to civilians, that it poses to the Sudanese nation, and potentially poses even to the region. There's also a very strongly shared view about the need for Generals Burhan and Hamedi to ensure the protection of civilians and non-combatants, as well as people from third countries, including our personnel who are located in Sudan. And also a strongly held view, again, across all of our partners on the need for an immediate ceasefire and a return to talks. Talks that were very promising in putting Sudan on the path to a full transition to civilian-led government.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The two top diplomats discussed Sudan on the sidelines of a meeting in Tokyo of foreign ministers from the G7 group of leading democracies. Cleverly joined Blinken in condemning the fighting.
UK has been in contact with our friends in the Arab region and will continue to do so. But I echo the points that have been made already by Secretary Blinken, that we call upon an immediate cessation of violence, a return to the talks which seem to be heading in the direction of civilian government, and of course that is the ultimate desired outcome. And we will continue working both with our close friends in the United States of America and our friends in Africa and the wider Arab world to bring about that move towards peace and a civilian democracy.
Both said they are in close contact with their diplomatic staff in Sudan and are working to ensure the safety of nationals from their countries. Both governments recommend against traveling to Sudan. Harry Verhoeven, a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University in New York. He wrote a book on Sudan politics called Water, Civilization and Power in Sudan, The Political Economy of Military Islamist State Building. Verhoeven tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the fighting between the army and the paramilitary force RSF is confusing, but it boils down to a long-time power struggle between the RSF leader Hamdan Dagalo and Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the leader of the Sudan army.
It's not always clear who exactly is fighting where. The easiest way, perhaps, of understanding some of it is that we know that the Sudan Armed Forces possess, of course, an air force and helicopters and fighter jets and have that capability, whereas the RSF probably in certain parts of the territory has more manpower at its disposal. And so both sides try to play to their relative strengths and try to surprise one another. But very quickly, of course, the humanitarian situation is getting quite serious. It's very difficult for people in urban centers in particular to go out, to get access to necessary supplies. And certainly in a country with so many people who live on the brink of poverty and who've been struggling so much for so many years, not being able to go to the market or to work and get your daily wages has a direct impact on how they live. And so from that perspective, what you hear a lot is rather desperate pleas for this to stop, coupled with that, the fear that it won't be like that, that this could potentially blow up, escalate, and perhaps even plunge the country into a civil war like we've seen in Libya or in Somalia or in Syria.
Now, a lot of people, they don't understand what this power struggle is between Hamedi and al-Burhan, because they were on the same side before when they were talking about going forward to you know, produce a transitional government, more or less on the same side. And now we're hearing that this is mainly a power struggle between these two men. So can you go into that a little and try to explain it?
Yes. I mean, the reality is that this is a tragedy that could have long have been foreseen, and that was really, in a sense, written in the stars already back in 2018, 2019, when the so-called December Revolution took place, which ended up overthrowing Omar al-Bashir, who had been president of Sudan for 30 years, and who had headed a military Islamist regime in which both Burhan and Hemeti and their respective institutions, the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, both supported the then dictator. However, you know, despite the fact that this was known as a military Islamist regime, many people in the army were, especially near the end of that time, very unhappy. They felt that the army had systematically received less and less money, had been less and less relied upon by Bashir, and that he had increasingly delegated authority and ever bigger budgets and ever more authority to the RSF and to a whole range of other state security agencies. So you had this pattern of security competition between different state security organs about who would be the dominant one. And therefore, for the army after the revolution in 2018, 2019, its single most important priority was to restore its own monopoly on violence and its own dominance within the security sector. It was much more important than the question of whether Sudan was going to be a democracy or an authoritarian state. And so what we've seen in the last couple of months in particular was heightened tensions between the RSF and the SAF, with SAF time and again trying to say, look, for us, this is really not a joke. Our top priority is to be the top dogs here. This is about the survival of the army as an institution and a country. And if you don't listen to us on this, we are ready to do whatever it takes. And this is exactly what you've been seeing in the last couple of days.
That's Harry Verhoeven, a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A Nigerian official says the death toll from a Saturday night attack by gunmen in northwest Kaduna State has risen to 33, while more than 40 houses were torched. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Witnesses said the heavily armed men invaded Runji village in Zangon Kataf district when residents were sleeping and started shooting. They also burned the village before security forces intervened. The head of the district, Francis Sani, said the dead have been buried and survivors are being treated. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but residents say armed groups known locally as bandits are to blame. Bandits were responsible for a similar attack 3 days earlier that killed 8 people in a nearby village. Kaduna State Governor Nasiru El-Rufai called the attack unacceptable and unjustifiable. State Police spokesman Mohammed Jalige told VOA Monday that authorities are investigating but did not comment on casualties. But security analyst Chidi Omeje says frequent attacks shows authorities are failing to protect the people.
The police haven't really been that much a serious factor in the entire fight against banditry. You know, because the police lack the capacity, they lack right leadership to take on such level of criminality. So it's a pity, really, because it shows clearly that we have not won the war against bandits.
Kaduna State authorities say security forces are in the area to maintain law and order. Banditry, kidnapping for ransom, and communal clashes are some of the security problems Nigerian authorities have been struggling for years to control. Decades-old sectarian violence in Kaduna has left thousands of people dead, and residents often accuse state authorities of willful neglect. Last month, rights group Amnesty International called on Nigerian authorities to put a stop to attacks after at least 35 people were killed in a separate incident in Kaduna. Nigeria is also battling an Islamist militant insurgency in the northeast that has lingered for more than 13 years. Nigerians went to the polls in February and March to elect new leaders. On Monday, outgoing Kaduna Governor El-Rufai chaired a meeting with his successor. Many hope that addressing insecurity will be the top priority for the new administration. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In Cameroon, the Muslim community is starting a week of prayers for peace against terrorism, crime, and a deadly separatist conflict. The prayers to mark the ending of the holy month of Ramadan comes after the military said scores of people were killed this month in separatist clashes. Authorities say there has also been a deadly crime wave in the capital, as Moke Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Hundreds of civilians gathered Monday in Konmiseng, a neighborhood in Yaoundé, to pray for peace in the Central African state. The civilians said they are praying for the welfare of the country troubled by terrorism, crime, and the ongoing separatist crisis in the mostly English-speaking West. Cameroon is a majority French-speaking nation. Claude Abbé is a sociology lecturer at the Catholic University of Central Africa in Yaoundé.
La vie est une valeur cardinale dans nos sociétés africaines. À partir du moment...
Abbé says he is a Christian, but has joined Muslims in prayer because human life, which was sacred and precious in Cameroon as it was in other African traditional societies, is today tribalized up to a point where some people kill at will. He says frustration, joblessness, religious intolerance, and poverty have led to increasing violence and barbarism all over Cameroon. Cameroon's military reports that at least 35 people have died in 3 weeks of fighting between government troops and the separatists, while 15 civilians were killed in an increasing crime wave in Yaoundé. In one scene reported by local media, a family of six was found dead with machete wounds in the town of Nanga Eboku. Other mutilated corpses were found on the street corners by civilians. Police say they are investigating what they call a spike in heinous crimes. Sitan Muhammadu Kongnyi is a Muslim youth leader at Nkomiseng. Kongnyi says the prayers for peace will be said in all Cameroonian mosques until the end of Ramadan.
Islam originates from the word peace, and we cannot practice Islam in an environment that is not peaceful. Cameroon is facing so many challenges as far as peace is concerned, especially when we consider the activities of Boko Haram, the rebels in the Central African border, and we consider the separatist fighters in the northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon. It is very important for all Muslims in Cameroon to intensify prayers for peace in this country.
The Council of Imams and Muslim Dignitaries of Cameroon organized the prayer for peace. The council's coordinator, Musa Umaru, says Cameroon will develop if its children embrace peace and stop the ongoing conflicts. Cameroon has been fighting within the past 10 years to secure its northern border with Nigeria and Chad from Boko Haram. Troops are also combating separatist fighters in Cameroon's English-speaking western regions, and the military reports that rebels from the Central African Republic regularly cross Cameroon's eastern border, kill civilians, seize their cattle, and abduct villagers for ransom. Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says Cameroon's government will welcome any initiative that can bring peace to troubled regions of the Central African state.
I told the religious leaders, especially the imam, that living together is something which is very important for President Paul Biya. I urge all the communities to work for the common good in a peaceful environment where Christians and other denominations work and live together without problems.
Muslims in Cameroon say the prayers will end with Eid al-Fitr, a religious holiday celebrated by Muslims worldwide to mark the end of the month-long dawn-to-sunset fasting of Ramadan. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Some South African opposition parties are set to sign a cooperation agreement to try to depose the African National Congress in next year's national election. The ANC has been in power for almost 30 years since Nelson Mandela led it to victory at the country's first multiracial polls in 1994 following decades of apartheid. But multiple crises blamed on the ANC government, including high unemployment, rampant crime, corruption, and debilitating electricity blackouts, means support for ANC is dwindling. Darren Taylor reports.
Polls are predicting the ANC will drop below the 50% plus one threshold it needs to form a majority government in 2024. If this happens, the ANC would only be able to keep power by going into coalition, probably with South Africa's third largest party, the Economic Freedom Fighters. The EFF, led by the charismatic populist Julius Malema, has often instigated violence and been accused of xenophobia and racism. The party has indicated it's willing to side with the ANC, but only if the ruling party agrees to implement EFF policies to destroy what it calls white monopoly capital so that poor black people benefit economically. These policies include an end to private ownership, with all forms of wealth, including land, banks, and mines, owned by the state.
Make no mistake, this will seal our country's doom.
John Steenhuisen leads South Africa's second biggest party, the Democratic Alliance. He says an ANC-EFF government will result in unprecedented loss of investment and rapid destruction of the economy. To prevent this, says the DA, it has drawn up what it calls the Moonshot Pact. Signatory parties to this will, in theory, agree to pool the votes they win in 2024. This, says Steenhuisen, should be enough for the Moonshot Group to keep the ANC and EFF out of government. In a video message to citizens via the DA's website, Steenhuisen said the DA and allies would then form a coalition government to lead South Africa to prosperity.
I know that you and your families face the prospect of a complete grid collapse, violent crime, as well as surging poverty and unemployment on a daily basis. But the prospect of a united opposition, setting aside our petty differences, in service of South Africa, can offer a powerful ray of light during this dark winter.
The Inkatha Freedom Party, the IFP, says the DA's pact makes sense. The IFP is a big political player in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa's most populous province. IFP leader Velenkosini Hlabisa says he'll work with anyone against the ANC.
The people of South Africa have been failed in many respects. Everything is moving to bad and to worse. People of South Africa have demonstrated in 2021, they showed by taking away the ANC from majority rule in the big metros and in municipalities, and this is unavoidable in 2024.
But others, like African Christian Democratic Party leader Kenneth Meshwe, aren't sold yet on the DA's proposal.
What the ACDP rejects is the big brother mentality, the headmaster mentality. They come and tell us that this is what we have planned to do. We must support them. That is what we do not agree with.
But, says Meshwe, his party is willing to listen if the DA shows a bit more humility.
There is no person in his right mind who can say we want the ANC to have another shot at government because the ANC have destroyed South Africa. We all agree about that.
In a media statement, the ANC said it's not threatened by any opposition pact, because it's confident it'll get all the votes it needs to continue governing alone come 2024. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.